The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
What do Evel Knievel and Loretta, the second wife of a polygamist Mormon man, have in common?
A very little, but also maybe a very lot. I think primarily the desire to sort of assert their own control over their life, maybe, to assert their own course in life. The idea of desiring freedom or being drawn towards something that you want to escape from or leap over. I guess that's maybe the spiritual connection I hope to draw.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Sean Vestal about his novel, Daredevils. When this story begins, Loretta is 15 years old. What's her life like?
She's living in a polygamist, fundamentalist Mormon community on the Utah-Arizona border. This is, I call it Short Creek, which it's still there, and it's still called Short Creek colloquially, but it's been formally renamed Colorado City since a raid in the 1950s. But she's living there in a family that is trying to sort of reestablish its righteousness, so to speak. Her parents had sort of drifted away from the fundamentalist faith and were trying to work their way back in. She's a rebellious kid, a kid who likes to sneak out and party with some of the outcast boys in the area, boys that the prophet in this community has basically exiled. She's deeply interested in leaving. She just wants out of this life. And her father, as a kind of punishment or effort to save her, perhaps, marries her into a polygamous family early in the book.
There's a scene in the book that describes that marriage, and I'd like you to read it. It begins on page 30.
They await Uncle Eldon, the prophet. The living room is insistently plain, with beige carpet and two long sofas, parallel and facing, and two love seats boxing them in, all upholstered in navy blue cloth patterned in small white flowers. The whole place seems uninhabited, Loretta thinks, though Dean and Ruth and the kids have lived there for going on 3 years. When the Harders first moved to this huge new house on the north edge of town, about 100 yards from the Utah border, it had started talk even then that Dean would take a new wife. Loretta's father and mother sit on a sofa, deferential to the day's events. She feels her mother's eyes seeking hers. Her father does not look at her, she knows. He made all the arrangements without her, including Dean's promise to wait until she turns 16 before consummating their union. It sickens her how far outside it all she stood. Loretta, Ruth, and Dean stand between the sofas in front of the fireplace, and Ruth holds a small pillow at her waist, as if she were preserving a treasure. Loretta knows it is the 3-strand ring of silver she will wear on the 3rd finger of her left hand. The children line up, tallest to shortest. Samuel, the oldest at 13, scowls, a fat boil behind one ear. He wears a black suit and white shirt buttoned to the collar, just as 7-year-old Dean Jr. does down the line. The girls just younger than Samuel, Ruth and Elizabeth, look like miniature sister wives in floor-length cotton dresses and long braids. Even 4-year-old Sarah and 5-year-old Janine wear long white dresses. Only Benjamin, the toddler, is clothed like a child in knee-length black shorts and a short-sleeved white pullover. He fidgets but holds his face firm, lips pressed with comical intensity as though he fears some noise will burst forth. He is her favorite, Benjamin. She catches his eye and smiles, and he returns the briefest furtive grin. The prophet arrives at last, entering hunched and slow on the arm of his burly son. He aims a gray, murmuring smile toward them. One milky eye wanders. He is a walnut of a man, tiny and parched and failing and skeletal, and his nearness to death only adds to his authority. They assemble, and Uncle Eldon stands in front, holding his knotty, trembling hands. Ruth and Loretta flank Dean, and the prophet rasps about exaltation and salvation and obedience to the Lord's sacred principle of plural marriage. He speaks in a soft monotone, pausing often as if to rest. "It is there, brothers and sisters," he says, "in Genesis, right from the beginning, Lamech and Esau and Moses and Jacob, all living in the principle." The prophet continues, speaking of the forsaken commandments and the world's abuse of the true saints. "The government of the United States has persecuted this priesthood," he says. "The Mormon church itself has per..." A fit of quiet coughing stops him. His son hands him a handkerchief, and when Uncle Eldon takes it from his mouth, a strand of saliva catches the light. "Has persecuted this priesthood," he whispers. His voice affects Loretta like a drug, a lulling sense of the sacred that goes deeper than her brain and whispers that she is wrong, that this is divine after all. Uncle Eldon talks about the raid of 53, when Satan sent the federal agents to arrest the men of Short Creek and carry away the women and children, and the constant threat of the next assault from the enemies of righteousness. "No righteous people live without remembering the sacrifices of their fathers," he says. In her head, Loretta flies to her worldly future. There, she wears pants with wide bottoms and colorful blouses with short sleeves, T-shirts even, and her hair hangs loose and long, and she paints her eyes with mascara. Every whorish thing. She wishes she could show her future self to her father and watch him burn. Her tussy future, pink and bold. This future could be anywhere else, and she will have a car, one of the sleek ones in the magazines, maybe the pink Mustang in the tussy ad, and she will listen to rock music and watch television, and there is no Dean or Ruth, of course, no Uncle Eldon, but there is no Bradshaw either, or any man. Or rather, there is a man, but he is no man she has ever known. He is a warm, anonymous shape, and he exerts no force. Uncle Eldon makes a rattling sound in his throat and continues. Loretta thinks she'll have to learn the names of cars and which ones she likes, so in her future she'll be able to choose the best one, the car that will show the world she is free, the car that will announce that she is this kind of person and not that kind of person. The prophet mentions the veil of heaven, and now they all engage in a charade in which Dean and Ruth stand on one side of a curtain held aloft by Loretta's parents, and Dean reaches through the veil for Loretta, and he pulls her through, pulls her to them, because this is how she will go to heaven, drawn there by Dean and Ruth.
What version of heaven will Loretta be drawn into?
The celestial kingdom, in their belief system. I grew up in a mainstream Mormon church, and so my knowledge of fundamentalist polygamy is sort of a research-based thing. But their afterlife is similar to the mainstream kind of afterlife, which is kind of a three-tiered. There's a celestial, terrestrial, and the telestial kingdom. It's not quite a direct heaven and hell kind of a situation. But the highest level of glory, I believe, is what they would call it. It would be the celestial kingdom, and that would presumably end in them becoming their own deities or the father, the patriarch of that family.
And so everybody else is just there to support him in heaven?
Yeah, basically.
Ruth doesn't agree with a lot of her husband's decisions, certainly not with this marriage to Loretta. In fact, it seemed like in one passage she feels like she's wiser than Dean is. Why doesn't she challenge him?
Because she believes in this arrangement. She believes. And she feels that perhaps that's what the Lord has asked her to do, maybe. That's part of her challenge or her job or her role is to overcome her desire to be more involved, I guess, to overcome what she might consider her pride and to submit her will. She sees that as the sort of most righteous expression of her life, I think, to ignore her will and do what she believes she is meant to do.
To submit to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the church is telling her is her role.
Yes. I mean, the mainstream Mormon church is patriarchal in the way many churches are patriarchal, but this is a particular, I would say, excessive kind of level of that in this fundamentalist kind of splinter community they live in.
What happens to change Dean's relationship to the community and to the church?
Well, he begins to make money, basically, in the simplest form. He begins to be financially successful. And in this community, and in this piece of it, I am imagining it, but there are polygamous communities that are fundamentalist Mormon communities that live what they call the law of consecration. It's basically a kind of spiritual socialism. Everyone turns over their money to the church, and the church takes care of them in return. And this was practiced in many early sort of Mormon communities. Many of the communities with Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were in charge of things in the very early days, lived some version of this. So Dean has a business and begins to prosper and begins to feel as if his fair share is maybe something less than all. He'd like to keep some of his own money. And this just begins to create tensions that lead to the division.
So he starts buying gold and stacking it up in a locked place, which comes in handy later in the plot.
Yeah.
Jason is Dean's nephew, and he's also Mormon, but not from a polygamous community. And when he first shows up in the book, he and his grandfather have ditched Sunday church services to watch Evel Knievel jump over the Snake River. And when they arrive at the launch site, they see all sorts of debauchery, drinking, and misbehaving. And Jason's grandfather says to him, "You've got to live in this world and keep it off you somehow." What's the strategy for that? How does that happen?
Well, I think the strategy would be to just, what his grandfather would say is don't hide away from it, but sort of know who you are, be certain in your faith and in your beliefs. And in my mind, and hopefully in the book, there's a distinction between these sorts of views that the religious people have, that the Mormon people have. There's the more outsidery kind of extremist role that Loretta lives in which all outside signals are sort of considered inappropriate and to be blocked. And there's the more mainstream family, which to some degree is going to be a part of the world, is going to try to exist within that world. And I think that's true of the Mormon church. I grew up in a Mormon family and did not feel like obscure outsiders. You know, we lived in the community. We lived among people who were Mormon and were not Mormon. And I think my parents' goal for us would have been that we were strong enough in our faith that we didn't have to hide away from the world, but that we were not influenced by, you know, evil things, quote unquote.
Jason's grandfather sets an odd example for him by lying to Jason's parents about where they're going. It seemed to really puzzle Jason.
Yeah. It's one of those things that anybody growing up begins to see, which is that there are the rules and then they're the exceptions, and almost everybody makes exceptions to rules, especially people with authority, like his grandfather, are able to somewhat pick and choose, perhaps, a little bit. And this is a pretty minor thing that they do, I believe. But in Jason's mind, it's major, and maybe he hasn't confronted a lot of this sort of skirting around of the rules.
It must be interesting to be a grown man in a patriarchal system, being taught that women have to submit to you, but then you have to submit to the male leader.
Yeah. Yeah. I never really thought of it that way, but it is a kind of a pyramid. it's a hierarchy, and it's explicit, but it's also implicit in so many ways. You know, the explicitness is less a part of it than I think the other kind of signs and signals that are just built in culturally. Yeah, it's a very hierarchical organization. Not long ago, I was somewhat jokingly comparing it to Amway. Everyone is above or below someone else.
I thought maybe Jason's grandfather's lie was a little bit of busting out of that being confined in some way.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, I've known plenty of different kinds of Mormons, and they're like all people. They exist on a spectrum. And I knew plenty of farmer, rancher, sort of Mormon guys who were, I would say, devout, but also still a little, you know, everybody's got their little worldly vices and diversions.
Rebelliousness
at
being told what to do.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Spokane author Sean Vestal is here, and we're talking about his novel, Daredevils. You can listen again or share this conversation with a friend from our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about Jason's desire to rescue Loretta and hear another short passage from the book. Don't go away. Jason decides that he can help Loretta escape from Dean and Ruth. So is he a little bit of a rescuer then?
Well, I think he wants to view himself that way. One of the things that I thought about a bit as I wrote the novel was that he's a well-intentioned boy, and yet, like every other man in the story, he has some designs on sort of taking Loretta and working her into his story in a way that Loretta wants to resist. Even the kindest, most helpful, friendliest sort of attitudes toward her still are a kind of overtaking of her life and fitting it into. And so that's what he's grown up with. You know, I think if you're a boy, especially if you were born growing up then, all the stories are about you rescuing women. Like almost all the stories are built upon that idea, and that you grow up with this idea that you validate yourself in that way or something, or that in some ideal world you would. There's a quote in Proust where he's in love with, I'm going to forget her name now, Madame Guermantes, I think is her name. And she's this rich society woman. And Marcel says he loves her so much, he wanted her life to just be destroyed. He wanted her to lose everything. He loved her so much, so she would run to him for help. And I was reading this when I was writing the novel, and I just thought that's kind of perfect, because that's not love, you know. Obviously, that's not love, but I think it's a common male sort of misconception, perhaps.
To mistake infatuation for love.
To mistake infatuation for love, and to think that the way that you can sort of aggrandize yourself and win someone's heart is in this way that minimizes them, you know, that the girl or the woman in that scenario is simply being rescued. You know, she's not an agent of her own destiny. And for me, I thought a lot about Loretta's desire to have agency, you know, and that even the smallest ways of losing that would be an affront to her desire to be an independent person.
Yes. I remember at one point she was thinking that all men want to turn her into something of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So there was ownership implied in every single relationship she encountered.
Yeah. And it took me a while in the writing of the novel to come to feel that way about Jason. I think early on in the drafting of this, I thought of him and his desire to save her a little more simply. I was a little more sincere about it, I think. But then as I began to write more from her consciousness and began to try to think more about who she was and how I might feel if I were her, I think I got a little bit radicalized. I was sort of like, oh, you guys get away. You know, you're all of you, even the nice ones are just trying to hog my life in some way.
Yeah, trying to tell her what to do or steer her in a certain direction.
And yet she also needs a little help. I don't mean she needs help from a man necessarily, but she needs some help. She needs some help from somebody.
Yeah. To get away from this life.
Yeah.
She does need help. Did the bunny bashing event really happen, or is that something you made up?
There were bunny bashes. I didn't see one, and there wasn't one in Gooding, where I grew up, but there was one. The last one was, I want to say, 1982, might be 1983, in Mud Flats, Idaho, eastern Idaho. They were periodic events. I mean, if you go back in time, they happened with some frequency all over the West, in places where jackrabbits were a pest for farmers. I remember reading a story about the one in Mud Flats, though, in the newspaper, and seeing a picture of a father and a son, each holding baseball bats and kind of smeared with a dark substance, you know, a black and white newspaper, but that I presume was blood, and feeling kind of repelled by it. At that time, that became kind of an issue. The New York Times wrote about it, and I think people just stopped doing it. That being said, I think it's a grotesque thing to do, but I also realized that the jackrabbits were a huge problem for someone trying to make a living as a farmer in southern Idaho.
Was the government raid in the 1950s an actual event?
Yes, it was. In 1953, the governor of Arizona had been on this campaign against polygamy, and supported in some way by the mainstream Mormon church, you know, which has taken pains throughout the decades to try and distance itself from polygamy, whether it's only official or not, I guess is another question. But there was some energy from the mainstream church behind this move to try to crack down on the fundamentalists. So he sent in state patrol officers to arrest men and haul away women and children. Some of the children apparently were never returned to their homes again. Many were kept away for a week or two. The police and the governor so misunderstood how this would affect people that they invited the press along. And there are photographs, Life magazine photographs, that I looked at a lot when I was writing this. In fact, I looked at those probably more than I read or researched the event to sort of try to feel what it might be like in those moments. Because it's easy for me to feel pretty judgmental about these people in this community and this faith. And I don't want to totally get away from that. You know, I'm not like a total blank slate. I have my own attitudes and judgments. But I also wanted to just empathize with them as people, you know. And as a writer, it feels more important to me to try to understand or create understandable portraits of them than judge them. And there's nothing that would radicalize you more than to have your children taken away from you. There's nothing that would, for your whole entire life, set you in your conviction that you are an outsider in a world that will do anything to you than that event. As wrong as I think what they did in that community was to young girls, it's a horrific notion, I think, that you would go in and take away, break up families in that fashion. And it's understandable to me that that would just harden these people in their attitudes, in their feeling of being pressed up against the wall by sort of an evil force. But, you know, just every outsidery attitude that they had just sort of like fired in a kiln by that event made more conviction for them.
It certainly would make distrust of the government their normal way of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where in the world did you come up with the idea to put Mormonism and Evel Knievel together?
I think it's just that both of those things are from my experience. And this novel isn't autobiographical, certainly not in the events. Some of the settings are, you know. Jason grows up in a world very much like the town he grew up in. That's the town I grew up in. So I put in, I don't know, the drive-ins, the restaurants. Those are the restaurants I grew up in. But the events didn't happen to me, but it's almost like the themes or the pieces of my life entered this book in an autobiographical way, and that's the real reason that Evel Knievel and Mormonism are in there, is that I've been interested in Evel Knievel for a while, and I grew up in a Mormon family in Idaho, and so those are just subjects of interest to me. Ever since I got older and found out more of the truth about Evel Knievel, I just have been drawn toward that persona, that huge distance between the image that he and the media projected and his reality, you know? And to me, that's maybe the thing about human beings, or one of the main things about human beings that is of interest, that defines us, which is the way that we can project a self. And I'm still flabbergasted to this day by the fact that Evel Knievel would put on a red, white, and blue suit and go stand in front of the cameras and tell kids to stay in school and believe in God and listen to your parents, and then go back onto his bus and have some sort of Caligula situation in there, you know. And he didn't seem to see much of a contradiction. I don't know. There's a documentary where he gave an interview where he, at one moment, he's just singing his wife's praises. Just what a wonderful woman she was. And then in the next breath, talking about that time he slept with the most women ever in Puerto Rico. Eight women, you know, just, I just think he's kind of everything in one he strikes me as American in a way that he can take these contradictions, put them all in one package, and not really even see them as contradictions or something. Just completely fail to see that these things don't go together.
I noticed that the sections titled Evel Knievel Addresses an Adoring Nation, that they went from the first one, which was one tone, and by the end of the book, they were just raves and rants.
Yeah. I loved writing those sections. They're also a little weird, you know, they're a little unusual. So the kids in the book, the other characters in the book, want some kind of freedom. And they're in a position where all they can see is the possibility, the potential, the beauty maybe of freedom. And I felt like I wanted another kind of a note in there that I hope he can provide, which is just the maybe the corrosive, the corrupting kind of influence of too much freedom or something. I don't, you know, he's someone who has no restraints other than gravity, I suppose. In the book, I would say it might have ruined him. I don't know. I couldn't say that about the real Evel Knievel, but in a way, I guess I felt like he might have been corrupted by freedom or something.
Hmm. Well, let's hear just the first Evel Knievel Addresses an Adoring Nation paragraph.
When did we first think of jumping a canyon? It seems now that we always thought it, that it was always there for us to think. What do you call that, when the world guides you toward its purpose? We believed, America. We believed we could do anything we tried to do. We believed we could do anything we said we would do. We believed in ourselves and the things we were saying. We believed that in saying these things, we were already making them true.
Kind of like fiction.
Yeah, I think so.
Sean Vestal lives in Spokane, Washington, where he writes a column for the Spokesman Review. He's the author of 3 books of fiction. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find poems and children's book reviews there, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.